Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-.
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Can you believe it? White Wine Question Time is playing live in the West End of London at the Leicester Square Theatre, and we would love you to come and join us. Come and raise a glass on the 13th of November. We've got the cast of Dumb Breeding. Joining me on stage will be Julie Graham, Alison Newman, Tracy Ann Oberman, Tamsin Outhwaite, Angela Griffin, and Denise Welsh. We'll be raising our glasses from 4 till 6. Why not come and pop your cork with us? Tickets are available now from Ticketmaster, Live Nation, wherever you get your tickets. Just a little heads up, this week's episode of White Wine Question Time features conversation that focuses on rape and sexual abuse. If you've been affected by rape or sexual abuse, please contact rapecrisis.org.uk, where you'll find full details on how to talk to trained, skilled listeners. On with the show.
Hello and welcome to White Wine Question Time, the podcast that asks its guests three thought-provoking questions over three glasses of wine. My guest this week is a woman who started her television career over 30 years ago after being promoted from the boss's PA to Weather Girl on TVAM. From there, she headed over to Saturday Night TV with Gladiators before cutting her comedy chops and holding her own on Shooting Stars alongside Matt Lucas, Bob Mortimer and Vic Reeves. She spent the first 12 years of her life living in her native Sweden, and when her mother left to move to England when she was just 8 years old, she was forced to grow up fast, caring for her father and her siblings. Hers was not an easy childhood, and she joined her mother in the UK 4 years later, and it's been home ever since. Despite her many professional achievements, they've often been overshadowed by her private life, which has to be said has been eventful. From her three marriages and their subsequent breakups, the fact that her four children have different fathers, her account of being raped as a young woman, her public assault at the hands of then-boyfriend Stan Collymore, her affair with a gladiator, and then years later, England football manager Sven-Goran Eriksson, the fact her second husband was the prize on Mr. Right, a dating show she was actually hosting. I mean, I could go on. It's been a lot. And through it all, though, she has never shied from talking about what's going on in her life with an honest, intelligent, frank, no frills directness that she credits as being entirely typically Swedish. It was this that went some way to her being voted the winner of Celebrity Big Brother in 2009, which was, let's face it, the ultimate popularity contest. These days, she writes a column for The Sun every Saturday and has appeared on Dancing on Ice, Celebrity MasterChef, First Dates Hotel, and most recently, SAS Who Dares Wins. So let's dial her up. It's Ulrika Johnson.
Hello.
How are you?
I'm all right. Not too bad. Yes, I forget half of the things that I've done, not in my private life, but like professionally. Sometimes if people ask me what I've done, I just go, I can't remember. Oh, yes, I did that. That's right. So, but yeah, so thank you for the reminder.
Yeah, so actually quite a few guests have quite a strong reaction on the show when they sit through their intro, because it is a bit of a Rolodex through their life, I suppose, isn't it?
Mm. But it was also very empathetically done, because so often, obviously, I've been the subject of press speculation and sometimes rubbish, sometimes truth. And so you're always looking for... I saw something yesterday online, and it was something I'd commented on something, and then they went, Ulrika's lost loves through the ages. I was like, first of all, you're making me sound like a dinosaur. And also, I didn't necessarily lose those loves. They lost me. Like, hello. It's always that whole kind of like unlucky in love narrative that people like to take, I guess. So, yeah.
As I researched this interview, it was like looking at old photographs when you wear terrible clothes that no longer look right. Because when you look back at how your life has been reported, it feels horribly dated in terms of the way you were often written about or treated. Mm. You've also, alongside that, you've always remained incredibly outspoken, sharing things publicly that others at that time would have shied away from. So, for example, when so many women didn't speak up about their experiences of sexual abuse, you spoke and wrote about being raped. Mm. You've publicly challenged ageism, sexism, misogyny, and most recently spoke about living in a sexless marriage. And in doing so, at times you've been treated and judged way harsher, I would suggest, than a man would have been in your shoes. And in hindsight, I think in ways which would be deemed as unacceptable now. So my question is, where does that voice come from, the one that refuses to stay quiet, no matter what the pushback and response?
Gosh,
massive question, but, I know.
Yeah, boom. Where to start? Well, first of all, I guess my voice comes from my Swedishness. So being brought up in Sweden, as you said in your intro, up to the age of 12, Sweden is probably one of the most egalitarian countries in the world. Women have an equal place at the table as men. Women aren't viewed at a lesser level or aren't marked differently publicly and definitely not sort of privately. And so I came to England, and I just thought about this the other day. I came to England and sort of, although I was only 12, I was fully expecting that, you know, girls and boys, you know, it would be the same kind of thing. Mm. Obviously, it's different when you're a teenager. But as I grew up, I suddenly thought, oh, my gosh, you are treated differently because you're a woman. And I never said anything throughout all those years kind of growing up and into my 20s. And like we've all kind of suffered at the hands of this sort of casual sexism that goes on in the workplace still. And I just kind of shut up. But inside I was kind of raging, and I was like, I don't understand this. This is harmful or childish or damaging or whatever. And so my voice definitely, I guess fundamentally for me, it's about honesty. And I like to give of myself. So I'm quite happy to say, yeah, that was a bad move. That was a sign of weakness. I don't want to like judge other people or situations from some sort of moral high ground. So I always think if I share a bit of me, my experiences and how I feel about situations, it will engender some kind of honesty in amongst other people, and they will kind of maybe reflect. I mean, that's not the reason I do it. I guess I say it because I'm a bit gobby, I don't know, but I try and do it in a nice way. I don't want to kind of, I don't need to be.
You obviously care, and you know, knowing you're not, you know, you're super smart. So you know, if you speak up on something, you know, there'll be pick up and attention and maybe challenge. So you have to pick your battles, and yet you've raised many over the years, and it never seems to dim your lights when people push back at you.
Well, I have to say it every time I write something or say something, I do feel I'm prepared. You know, there is a kind of really difficult exposure that you have to kind of come to terms with. And I'm quite thin-skinned, believe it or not. I do take people's comments and whatever. They do hit home, and they can be really hard for me to kind of deal with. But it doesn't change what I need to say. It doesn't change the picture that I'm trying to sort of paint or what I'm trying to describe. So, yeah, I do get kind of, I walk away a little bit kind of damaged when people, but that's part of kind of, I guess, that thing of wanting to be liked by everybody and realizing at 54, that ain't going to happen. You're just not going to be liked by everybody. So,
but you have to remember that you don't like everybody. So that's okay. You know,
that's just human nature, isn't it? Yeah, it is. I think it's a hard and a slow lesson. Although some people, you know, that I look at that are so thick skinned and don't care. And they're like, you know, you can't be insulted. And I'm like, I'm in awe. I'm like, well, and then I think, oh, I want to be like them. And I finally now at my age sort of suddenly realized that actually I am me and I have to start liking and approving who I am rather than always wanting to be something that I'm not. But I think the honesty and that genuinely does come from the kind of the Swedish thing. I think that there is nothing simpler than the truth. There's nothing simpler than honesty. Of course, it's massively complicated because you're often kind of planting a bomb somewhere that's going to go off or whatever. But it's, I always try and instill that in my children, is that, you know, if you're honest, you can't be at fault for telling your truth or what it is that you feel. It may not be viewed as correct or right by other people, but yeah, I feel like honesty is such a fundamental part of my character and personality. And I guess either that's who I am or that's just part of the Swedish soul in me. I don't know. Maybe a mix of the two.
The Americans call it pushing the envelope.
Oh, yeah.
When you really push the envelope. When you bring a conversation to the table that's contentious or difficult. Mm. So when I was reading back on your life, I mean, when you wrap the Me Too movement around this now, it feels very uncomfortable. When you wrote about being raped as a teenager, the response, certainly on a sort of press level, was quite intense speculation around it. People were sort of saying things like, well, why didn't you go to the police? In other words, you said you felt that you were, as a woman, somehow at fault with that response. Is that right?
That's 100%. Correct. So that was in my autobiography, which came out, 2002 or something, so 100 years ago.
That's nearly 20 years ago, yeah.
Yeah, and the rape took place when I was, 19, so whatever year that would be, 86, something like that. There was no such thing as date rape in those days. In those days, it was still okay to rape your wife. You can still force yourself on your wife, effectively. Nobody talked about these things. So the reason I brought it up in my autobiography was because this was something that happened to me, and it helped shape who I am. All our experiences shape who I am. It wasn't like either an attention-seeking thing. It's part of my makeup and how it maybe changed my relationship to sex or my relationship to men. So it was really important. So obviously years on after that, when it came out in my autobiography, it very much became a thing, as you said, about why didn't you go to the police? It did not even occur to me. They would not even occur to me that if you were meeting somebody and in a hotel room, which sounds really seedy, but you know, I completely felt like I didn't have a leg to stand on, and I kind of felt like you almost felt like you had kind of invited it, or it you had kind of, I guess, helped make it happen. And that's part of the whole story that as women we've been living with for decades, centuries, which is the fact that we haven't had a voice and nobody has really spoken up. And if you have spoken up, the patriarchy has always shut us down and like don't make a fuss, get back in your box kind of thing. So if it happened to me today, I mean, number one, yes, I would go to the police. Number two, the state of, rape prosecutions would probably also put me off. So, I mean, I'm still at that stage where I'm going, what would I do and how would it feel? So I think we've obviously moved on massively, but equally, you know, the hard legal facts speak volumes about where we're still stuck, I guess.
Absolutely. You know, and there was also reports of around the time that you were attacked by Stan Collymore. And what I literally read with kind of sort of wide eyes was this sort of, again, inference that because you were drunk or had been drinking, and then they supplied kind of information around it, like some people reported that she was, you know, dancing and
took her top off.
Which you say wasn't true. But no. The fact is they reported that, and the inference is that, well, she was drunk. It's a bit like...
She was asking for it. Yeah.
Yeah.
No.
And, I mean, that would not sit on any kind of news title or news website now.
It definitely wouldn't.
But that must have been very difficult, Ulrika.
Yeah, I think all these kind of episodes in your life, you box up and you sort of put them away. I held on very strongly to my truth and the fact that there was hundreds of witnesses and a camera crew there. Mm. The fact that I'd had a drink should not make any difference. So I was
whatsoever.
Happy drunk. I wasn't pissed out of my head. I was happy drunk. I was with somebody who had just threatened to murder me. He's going to kill me, and then asked to speak to me. And then it happened very quickly. But after that, yes, you're absolutely right. The inference was very much about, you know, she's lively.
Your behavior.
My behavior was, she's lively. She was in a pub. I was downing a pint. Yeah, mustn't do that.
And so what? But nobody said, what was his state of mind? What was his behavior that evening?
But what did he do? I mean, it was witnessed. I mean, it was a kind of a public event. I was very lucky that it didn't happen privately, because I don't believe, I don't know how or if I would have come out of it. Because, you know, I was lucky there was other people that it took, you know, two men to restrain this person. Yeah. So in many respects, I was really lucky. But I also afterwards, a few years after that, spoke to a couple of sort of premiership footballers that I knew. And they said, well, exactly what you said. We heard you took your top off. And you were kind of like, you were really goading him. And I was just flabbergasted. And I didn't even go into any kind of defense or anything, because I just felt that's just an uphill struggle. I'm not here to convince you of what happened. I know very well. But also, I mean, granted, you know, the football world is very, very masculine. It's very male. It's very, very testosterone fueled. So, you know, I would hear stories.
But you know what? You and I have both raised boys. They will be neither of those things because they know it's unacceptable.
Definitely not.
So yeah. you can't excuse that kind of idiotic abuse because they live in a masculine world.
Yeah. Well, no, it's a historic thing and it still goes on. I mean, there's still, I've actually stopped following the football. I will follow the football when the World Cup is on and when the Euros are on. I am there. I will watch every game, work permitting. But I've given up on the Premiership or whatever it's called now, because I just felt that world is just, whilst I love football, everything sort of around that world just gave me a kind of bad taste in my mouth.
So when those Premier League footballers kind of said that to you, you felt deflated, defeated. You didn't challenge them.
I didn't challenge them. No, I mean, it's like Chinese whispers. they've heard from someone who's heard from somebody, you know, it becomes that kind of thing.
But also, is it a case of like you just being tired of having to try to justify and explain yes. something that to other people makes absolute sense? It's that we're tired thing.
Yeah. And I think that that's actually something that many women identify with. I'm actually just exhausted with constantly either explaining yourself, justifying yourself, or trying to convince someone of something. And it just felt like, you know, I said my little piece and then parked it. I mean, what would have been smart would have been to have started some kind of campaign like the Me Too movement, like Me Too or even the Casual Sexism project or whatever. It's when I think back now, I just think, God, you know, you should have said something or you should have done something. But I guess...
You did though. You explained on a on a public level what had happened to you. So you did speak up. You didn't. I mean, there was no denying it. It was captured, wasn't it? And like you say, you had plenty of witnesses to support what had happened. But at that time, it must have been with those kinds of comments being pushed back at you. Very difficult because there's no justifying a man raising his or anybody raising a hand to another human being. You can't justify that behavior.
I think the way that I framed it was very much that for anybody who's been in an abusive relationship, they'll know that it's not just one part. It may not just be a physical part. And this man had never raised a hand to me before this moment. But the psychological control and the abuse that he caused during the course of our on-off, I can't even call it a relationship because it really was not, it really wasn't. That was more damaging to me than what had happened to me physically. So I, it took me kind of longer to get over. To get over what had gone on before, the kind of never knowing where I stood or what was happening and the constant pushing and pulling and the control and the, you know, trying to withdraw me from my friends, all the things that are classic kind of, you know, abusive relationship things. Bit of coercive control. I mean, nobody'd heard the term coercive control in those days. I mean, I didn't even know, not that that happened, but, you know, the whole thing about financial control as well, that did not happen when I was in this situation. But I didn't even kind of think about that would be. And all I know is that, you know, members of my family, my agent, who was a very close friend, just said, you changed so dramatically over that time. You just became a completely different person because I was on edge the whole time. I was constantly tense and hyper and insecure and I just completely lost myself. So when the kick in the head happened, that to me was like, those bruises, they went away, but the stuff that had gone on before was kind of harder to process. Because again, being a woman, I naturally went, well, what did I do to invite that? What was my responsibility? And which is kind of a weird way of framing it.
But yeah, because you would never allow your daughters to think like that. Well, you certainly wouldn't encourage your daughters to think like that.
No,
were
no,
they,
no.
You know, unfortunate to be in that situation. So, when you look back on what you had going on in your life and how public it was and how you wrapped a narrative around it, you always provided an account from your side. There weren't very many women in the public eye doing that at that time. And I think in so many ways, A, it must have been very lonely, but B, you were quite ahead of your time. quite ahead of your time.
Yeah, it's funny. Somebody said that to me. I can't remember. I don't know if I was doing an interview or having a discussion with somebody. And they said, you really were kind of ahead of your time in many kind of this wasn't a particularly positive light or whatever else, but doing things differently to other people. And I mean, it's very funny because the Swedes have an expression, and I'm a little bit known up there. Obviously, I've not done masses of work up there, but they know of me. They know the Swedish girl who's gone over to England. And when I've done interviews with them, they're normally like super supportive and really sort of admiring and all that stuff. And they have an expression and they always say, "You run your own race." And I kind of love that expression. It just means that I don't ever sit down in any sort of manipulative way and go, right, I'm going to engineer this so that I can really strike out and be different from anybody else. It's just things happen, and this is my instinct. This is what I need to do. This is what I feel is the right thing to do. And I feel like convention just goes to the side. Mm-hmm. I have to get from A to B, and whatever's in the way, I will just try and clear that. So there's a determination, I think, about my personality. I don't think necessarily that's a self-confidence, but there's definitely a determination there.
Yeah, I mean, that definitely rings true because of all the things that we've discussed already, the fact that you don't lower your voice. And and that's that, and you don't. And you're now writing a column where, you know, you have to have a big opinion every week about something. Mm. And you seem, A, you write brilliantly, and B, you seem very confident in that role now.
Yeah, I've always loved writing. So writing, ever since I was about, 9, 10, I had this vision. I wanted to be a writer, and wrote the most terrible stories about horses and rubbish, you know, just awful. And so writing was always a thing. And when I became a teenager and I had quite a strict upbringing when I came to England, my only outlet was to write. My voice wouldn't be heard in the house. I was too scared to sort of proffer my opinion. And so writing down my feelings was really a great sort of way of offloading. And so it's always sort of been a comfort to me, I guess. And secondly, I love the English language. Swedish is really useful if you want to live in Sweden, but it's not really useful anywhere else. But the English language is I just love it so much. And my favorite book is the Thesaurus. That's so sad.
Is it really?
But no, I mean, I definitely could, like, I just love it. I just think there are so many different ways of expressing yourself. And I think even though I have to have an opinion every week in the Sun, there's no agenda. They don't tell me what I have to write. There's nothing like that. It's kind of instinctive, or it's whatever comes out at me from the week's proceedings and whatever. But
sometimes you're not afraid to turn the story in on yourself. You know, you wrote a brilliant piece alongside your daughter about your fears. Her father upped and left literally as she came out of surgery with heart problems at birth. And he's been, am I right, absent ever since?
Yeah.
And then he suddenly finds your daughter and contacts her, and you write a piece explaining that situation, which is complicated and difficult. And you did it in a really balanced and fair way, I thought.
Yeah.
And then Bo came in and gave her take on it.
Yeah.
And I thought it provided a lot of colour in an issue that is often seen as terribly black and white.
Mm. Yeah, and I think that, as you grow older and you listen to more people's, I'm fundamentally really interested in people's, I love hearing people's life stories. And I come across so many people who go, I never knew my dad, or my mum left. That's less common, but, you know, and obviously my mum had left me when I was 8. We were still in touch, but she left the country. But so many people have had experiences, or they find out they're adopted when they're adults, all that sort of stuff. And for me, I just thought, this is a really kind of important story to tell. And how do I process the feelings that I have when, you know, when he left, I was so incensed. I was so raging because he was the one who was desperate to have a child. And of course, I wanted to too, but, you know, my maternal instincts were like that from the age of 10. And then I was left holding this baby and a sick one at that. And I was so, it took me so long to get over that. And then we got through life without him. And then, as often happens in life, people pop back in to your life. And it was really important. I've never really had big, deep conversations with her about it. She's quite a closed book. So when she wrote that piece for The Sun, it was the first time she touched upon many of the feelings that she had, and it was the first time that I'd heard them. So I was really,
wow.
Yeah, it was really? it was quite a cathartic thing. I'd never heard her say, you know, I would ask him, why did he do this to me and mum, and why were we so bad? What couldn't he stand about? And I thought, wow, has this been going on inside you? Because I'm a liberal parent, but I'm also like, I want them to know that they can speak to me about anything at any time. And I think that's like the most fundamental and best parenting thing that I can do.
Yeah.
Get a lot of things wrong, but hopefully that's one thing that I can get right. But Bo is very closed emotionally. I say she's emotionally constipated. She really is kind of struggles to kind of, she doesn't find it easy like me. I can go blah, 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 blah. And maybe that's also quite intimidating if you have somebody who just goes blah. And for her, it's like she just closes off. So genuinely, when she wrote those things, I was like, wow.
Wow.
And it was a really kind of lovely, we're very, very, very close anyway, but it gave me an insight into what she's feeling. Because my point was, I never wanted to sort of sully his name in front of her. I wanted her to make up her own mind. I could have spent the past 21 years saying, what an ass. He did this, that, and the other. And, you know, talk to her about the pain and all that stuff. But I feel like there will come a time, possibly, where she might want to meet him. And it's important that she makes up her own mind at that point.
Yeah. And also raises her own questions, right?
Yeah.
That's what she's arrived at now as a young adult is she's got her own questions. It's not what she's heard parrot fashion at home.
Yeah.
It's her own conclusions that she's trying to arrive at.
Yeah.
I thought it was really powerful. And in an age where we all live in different iterations of what a family unit is, I thought it was yeah, really, really helpful.
Yeah, no, it was actually also really lovely to hear her say that I never felt, I mean, she's incredibly close to me, and that's because we did a lot of it on our own, and she was, you know, she was potentially going to die at any moment. You know, it was that kind of intense relationship. So her connection with me is possibly stronger than my connection with any of the other children, purely because of that, not because of that I love
that intensity,
anymore,
yeah.
Love the others any, yeah. But hearing that she sort of said, I didn't really feel like I needed a dad in many respects. I think I was both for her. And then she also had a couple of really great father figures. My ex-husband, you know, who eventually adopted her.
Yeah.
You know, all those things gave her a sense of belonging, and there wasn't that gap or that hole there. And actually, in fact, I think a lot of people that I've come into contact with or who have contacted me who have had a situation where a parent has gone or is no longer in their life, the other parent plays both roles, which is exhausting, but it does mean that you're compensating, and sometimes people feel that they're not missing anything. I mean, well, how can you miss something that you don't know? I mean,
exactly.
So
he was never there to miss, was he?
No.
Well, I think, yeah, you know what, as a mum reading her piece, that must have been emotional for sure, but also incredibly cathartic to know that actually she's emerged from it all
robustly, I would say, if that's truly how she feels. I think you've done a marvellous job in a difficult situation. And it's not often we give ourselves enough credit as parents, especially single parents.
No. And I think, as I always make this joke about how I go to bed at night and criticise all the things I got wrong that day during, you know, parenting. And as a general rule, and this is terrible, it's a sweeping statement, blokes go to bed at night and fall asleep. And that's always the analogy I used to use. So I used to kind of watch my ex-husband just hit the pillow, snore, and I'd be lying there going, oh God, I should have done that better. Wish I hadn't done that. Just a different...
Literally ransacking your day for faults. Yeah.
Absolutely. Yeah.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Question number two. The definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different outcome. We all do it, but to varying degrees. When and how is that true for you?
Ooh.
I mean, it can be as big, as small as you like. I'm still taking myself out once a year, pretending I can run, realizing I can't, realizing I hate it, and parking it until the next year I forget like a goldfish and do it again. Insane.
And do it again.
I hate running.
Thank you. Hallelujah. I used to do running, but now when I run, it looks like I'm running for help. So I try and avoid it. And,
or cover. And it,
help me. I know I really do. And now I've got arthritis in my hips. I mean, basically, shoot me now. Don't shoot me
never,
now.
Never going to happen.
I think, gosh, you could apply that in so many, I guess, different aspects. Like, for example, I remember even so dark, because obviously a large part of my life is now also about cooking and one thing and another. And many years ago, a few years ago, I was making a wedding cake for my brother, and for some reason it just kept not working. I think I went through like 54 eggs in the end, and clearly I was doing the same thing and the outcome was the same again, and then I had to kind of like cut and paste and make it work somehow. And it was weird just using that sort of analogy in reference to other things in life. We're just going, but it says I should do it this way. I'm going to do it this way, but it's still not changing. I think from a personal perspective, I guess it could be that my approach to relationships, if we want to get deep and personal, has always been to always give of myself. I wear my heart on my sleeve. I am not scared of showing my emotions. I kind of love that first thing when you meet somebody and you feel something and that excitement, and sometimes it works out really well. Sometimes, a few times it works out well. But that whole thing of surrendering yourself to somebody else has been, I guess, in a way, you know, at a personal cost. You know, you sometimes wonder, like, just hold back. Just like ease off.
Have you not learned?
I mean, it's not like I'm some sort of stalker person who's like, I don't chase, but that whole thing of like loving and embracing and being so full of it, it's like, just temper things. Just take a breath and take a
but
step.
But if instinctively
back.
That is you and that is your response.
I know that's the difficult thing. How do you unlearn that? Because when it has to do with feelings and when it has to do with emotions. So the cake was all about a practicality. There was emotion involved. I was wanting to make a lovely wedding cake, but it was about practicalities, right? So there was something in the method or whatever. But when you're dealing with emotions, like you say, that's who you are. That's your soul. That's how you function. And I think I spent many years going over things and thinking, you've got to get a grip. You've got to change as a person. And then sort of, I guess, almost now realizing, and really up until now, that I am who I am. So I have to accept that. And when you accept that, you also have to accept that you could be doing the same thing and time again, and it leads to exactly the same result. But then you have to be prepared to acknowledge that and accept that. So that's kind of the payoff or the consequence, maybe.
It's kind of the chemistry or the science or the ingredients piece of this, though, isn't it? If you take it away from cake and into relationships, which is, I don't know, maybe this isn't what you think, but ultimately the hope is that one day you will meet somebody, and when you are absolutely authentically your overgiving self, they will just go, that's perfect. That's exactly a good fit for
come
me.
Come to me,
and
yes.
And the two come together.
That's what I think.
Is it a madness that you keep trying the same thing? Well, it would be if you kept trying it with the same person.
Yeah.
But science would suggest that you are searching in different sort of, you know, chemistry pools.
Yeah, oh, most definitely. I definitely don't have a type, or I do believe that I've never understood that with women when they go, when they're looking for someone, it's got to be this, that, and the other. And I've always thought, but if you're trying that all the time, like, how are you getting any variety in your life? How are you learning anything new?
No, exactly. I mean, gosh, when you look back over, you know, your different partners, I mean, there is no type, a gladiator versus Sven-Goran Eriksson and, you know, Mr. Right in between.
Well,
you didn't keep going back for the same sandwich, did you?
Like a bit of tuna mayo, a little bit of chicken. I know. Well, I think that's like, I can hear my dog whinging outside. Let me just let him in.
Don't worry.
Sorry. You can come in. Okay, but you can't like whinge about going out again. Okay, so you're in now.
Can I just ask, do you think he understood what you just said?
Oh, he kind of gave me, hi. You gave me a look, didn't you?
Yeah, I love that.
Of course he understands.
I think you've got your best relationship to date right there. It's a conversation with somebody that can't talk back.
And who I believe understands what I'm saying and believes
and agrees with everything.
And goes... Yeah, he is. He's so perfect. And he's really lovely because he sleeps in bed with me and we don't have to have that awkward conversation about when he's leaving in the morning. It's just not.
There you go. You know what? You found your love. You gave it your all and there is somebody there.
Absolutely.
So
it is true. It is true. gosh, what were we saying?
The difference in the men you've dated.
Well, I've always thought that it's, don't you think this as well, that it's a chemistry? So when you met your husband or any former boyfriends or whatever else, it's a thing that you can't describe. Like something that sort of happens between two people. Or I go, oh my God, I love his hands. And that becomes like a trigger. Or, oh, I love the way he laughs, or I love his smell. I mean, I'm very instinctive in that respect. I'm not the girl who goes, He's got a great job. He drives a nice car. He's right for me. If I'd done that, I think I'd probably be in a better place right now. But, you know, yeah, no, I just.
Yeah, but you lead from the heart and not the head.
Yeah, exactly. And I was going to say, it probably goes much deeper than that, back to childhood, where you just, maybe if you didn't feel proper unconditional love in your childhood, and I don't think I did, and I won't be the only one. I certainly was loved, but the unconditional aspect of things I didn't feel. So then you're kind of always, you're searching for that.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right, because I don't think, you know, you have written about your relationship with your parents, and it feels like as much as they loved you, they were ultimately, their choices put themselves first. And as a parent, that's not something I don't think you've ever felt that you would do.
No, I mean...
Or have you? I'm putting words in your mouth here, sorry.
Well, I'm putting myself quite high up right now for the first time.
Yeah.
Actually,
yes, by calling an end to your last relationship. Yeah. That was ultimately putting yourself ahead of... Would that be the first time, do you think?
Well, I mean, I brought about my second divorce as well. So I guess that was an aspect, but I think that was a mutual thing in many respects. But yes, in my last marriage, which was with the person I genuinely believed, I mean, we were together for 12 or whatever years, that I genuinely believed we would be together forever. Co-parent really, really well, still do, still get on very well, but then just decided that one aspect, well, it wasn't one aspect, it was many aspects of our relationship was not enough to sustain me. And again, I think I just turned 50 or whatever, and thinking, you know, again, that thing of like, more years behind you, what are you going to do with your life? And it was really, you know, it wasn't something that you make a decision about, you know, in 20 seconds. You know, your marriage doesn't just end. It often has a slow, kind of painful death. But yeah, no, I'm very much about now as well. You know, I've been a mum for 27 years, and which is half my life now. Yeah, what am I? 54, maths is rubbish, but yeah. I think that's right. and I've all, you know, for me, my life has been about family or career. There hasn't been that space where I've found, like, who am I? What am I about? You know, like, I know a lot of mums can be good about, you know, going, finding time for themselves. I never did that. For me, it was either had this overbearing sense of duty all the time. So the whole idea of relaxing or doing something away from my children was really foreign to me. Mm. And so now I've been really clear with them, and I've gone, just so you know, I'm going to be dating. I'll be here for you forever and for always and in every way that I can. But just know that I am doing some things for myself now. And they were a bit.
And how was that? What, how was the response to that?
They were like, a bit gross. Yeah. Well, obviously, like, oh my God, my mum has sex TMI. Or whatever. But yeah exactly. a kind of, I mean, the age range is, so, you know, 27, yeah. 21, 17 and 13. So for the youngest, it's all a bit, when I sort of said this a couple of years ago, a year ago, whenever it was, he didn't really kind of understand. I guess he thinks that when a man and a woman meet, they get married and that's it. And that whole concept that you might meet more than one person and go out and date, so to speak, was quite, a foreign one to him. And why wouldn't it be? Yeah. All he's seen is his mum and dad together.
Totally.
The other sort of understood, I think my oldest was a bit like, I do think I'm a bit cringe for him sometimes, but I'm like, but, you know.
What, because of what you write about or what you share publicly?
Well, again, I'm really kind of open with them about that too. Like, I go, oh, by the way, I'm going to be nude tomorrow in the papers. Yeah. Or
but just because you're open about it doesn't make them comfortable, does it?
Oh no. They literally go, they genuinely, like, I just kind of hear a deafening silence at the other end, and or I hear the rolling of the eyes, go, oh my God, here she goes again. I do get, Bo actually is normally quite supportive, and she goes, very proud of you, Mama, which I don't know if it's just a gratuitous throwaway thing, but it's lovely to hear. I mean, the other weird thing, and we're going into something else now, but the other weird thing is my youngest has never really known me being super famous or whatever, because I've had a quiet few years, and partly deliberate, taking a step away from things. So he doesn't know about shooting stars or gladiators or anything like that. He will have possibly other people saying, oh, your mum's famous or whatever else. And my oldest will know about those things, but he was a baby or a toddler or whatever else. So he wasn't really. So I think, you know, while he was young, it didn't matter what it said in the papers about me because he couldn't read or anything. Yeah. But now, of course, now we live in this digital world where everything's accessible for everyone and, you know, all that thing. So it's kind of, they know what I do. And if they question anything, and I say, look, just so you know, I'm doing a nude shoot, like I did a menopause shoot a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And I was naked for it. Obviously, they covered all the unnecessary bits out, all my plumbing. But I said, you know, just so you know, I will be naked. And I go, mate, do you want to eat? Right. Then this is what's happening. I'm doing this.
Is that what you put on the table?
I'm feeding you, can eat.
I am contemplating an OnlyFans.
Why not?
Actually, just to piss them off.
I think you do really well on OnlyFans, Ulrika.
Because I'm good friends with Kerry Katona, and she was the one who was going, you got to do it, we were laughing about it. But no, it does make them cringe. But I, you know, they have to acknowledge that this is what I do. And they also love the rewards of what I do, that when I can arrange something special for them because I might know somebody or whatever else. So, you know, shut up.
Shut up. I'm naked.
Shut up.
Deal with it.
I know. Well, it is awkward. And I guess also it's awkward because, you know, everybody's situation has changed. You know, I was married and we were all together. There was six of us at home or whatever else. Two of them have now moved out. In a year's time, another one moves out. It's just going to be me and one other. It's God. That's also kind of like life's changed and it evolves. And yeah. I don't think you're ever prepared for that as a mum, because as a mum, you just go, oh, I want to have a baby.
That's massive, actually. Yeah.
I want to hold the baby.
It's a huge changing of the guard.
Yeah. No, it's and very hard for someone like me who just wanted to have children and have them around. Now I'm like, get them out the way, but in a nice way. I'll probably miss them when they're all gone.
Get them out of the way. I'm ready for act three. It's called me.
Yeah, exactly. It totally is starring me.
Good for you. Why not? Okay, my third and final question to you, and I hope it's a straightforward one, is can you identify a moment that was intrinsic in being the making of you?
Gosh.
It's not that simple, is it?
That is a really brilliant question. I think I've had so many. I was going to say, there's been so many. But I would say, in a way, this last episode of my life, as I am moving into the autumn of my life, I feel is the making of me, because if I hadn't divorced my husband, I would still be in a relationship and in a situation, and I would not be forced to learn about myself in the way that I am. I've always, always been very much in touch with who I am, why do I do things, whatever else, but I've never really kind of understood it. So I think it's a feeling for me now of finally being at ease with who I am. And part of that is age, but part of that is also the fact that I am on my own. I mean, I have children and I have a supportive ex-husband or whatever else. But fundamentally, to start your life, it feels like to start your life over, not over again, but start that phase of your life. So what will I have been, nearly 51 or whatever, on your own is not only terrifying, but has been really cathartic. And I mean, there are other moments, I guess I could say that, you know, maybe when my mum left and I had to just be, you know, take control over things in my life at the age of 8 and look after my dad and blah, blah, blah. All those things have been like little steps, some plateaus that have sort of like helped build up the person that I am today. But I do feel sort of, you know, the whole menopausal thing as well. Mm-hmm. I do feel like a different person, or that I'm getting to know, more importantly, getting to know who the real person is.
Well, you've got the time for the first time since the age of 8, because from the age of 8, you have been caring for other people. You married, your first marriage, you were very young. You had a child very young. So literally from the age of 8 until the age of 51, you were constantly responsible for others. I think you've earned your right to sit alone and work out who you are.
Yeah. No, some people are so self-assured, aren't they? And they know right from the beginning and they're really cool. And I always envied them. They'd be so, like, knew exactly who they were. And I just felt all over the place. Like, I thought, I'm several different people, all mashed up into one thing. And then not helped by the fact that I chose a career in the limelight, which then paints you in a certain light. So you have a persona, and then you're privately, you're very different. I mean, that's been one of the joys. I know I'm going off on a tangent now, but it's been one of the joys of, like, the only social media I do is Instagram. And that's been one of the joys of, like, going, oh, here's a picture of the food I've made or the flowers I've grown or whatever else. And people go, didn't know you like gardening, didn't know you cooked or whatever. And I think, no, there's so much about me that you don't know, because, you know, a picture's been... But the mere fact that you have this kind of public, there's a public persona and then there's your private self, means that, you know, there's been a lot of internal conflict. I think now I feel like I know myself a little bit better. And when making decisions, and I'll continue to make bad decisions, of course, because that's crucial. We don't want to have an easy life.
But it's also life, right? We don't, none of us get it right all the time. None of us.
No, definitely. Well, I'm glad to hear it, because sometimes you do think that you're the only one who gets things wrong. But that's that thing of, you look at other people's lives.
Yeah, you don't do anything at all, and you just stay where you are. And that might not be great. That might not be happy. That might not help you, you know, realize your full potential. So there's a danger in that as well. Stagnating.
I mean, that is really true. A lot of people will opt for the status quo, and I guess I've never done that. And it's not been about, oh, I don't want to stand still, I'm so, you know, I've been very, very happy to live where I live in my little house and just stay away from the outside world. But then I've kind of inadvertently, even going and doing, you know, Celebrity SAS, like that was a really coin dropping moment, because what came out of that, what the sort of psychologists, because as you know, every TV show now you have to be psychologically assessed. And the psychologists came out, you know, and just said to me, like, you have to stop and like look after yourself and take time out for yourself. And I remember being told, like, I want you every day to get a cup of tea and just sit down on the sofa for 10 minutes. I was like, what? Who does that? Like, I should be doing something. So now I've developed a relationship with my sofa, which is amazing. And I just never knew so many good things come out of doing nothing.
Well, there you go.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a valuable life lesson right there.
Yeah.
So maybe sometimes being still isn't the wrong thing. It's just don't stay still for too long.
No, exactly. And also does not, it's what you're prepared to accept, isn't it? And understanding that everybody has a different level of tolerance. So, you know, I mean, I just wrote a piece about, you know, everyone criticizing Colleen Rooney for staying with Wayne Rooney. And I was like, well, you know, there was a time when I too was like, yeah, why aren't you? Why are you being so weak? And it's like, well, no, she's made that choice. This is what makes her happy. She knows she can go off and do what she wants, but she's made this choice. And that is what brings her happiness. And who are we to judge that? You know, it's a tough one. It's such an individual thing. I still love the idea of marriage, though. I'm not going to.
Oh, my goodness.
I promise.
Are you really?
I promise I won't get married again. No, I promise. Like, well, this is the lovely thing.
You.
This is so, that's the massive change, is that I'm no longer like looking for the one. I think all my life I was looking for the one, and I'm not anymore. I'm in a completely different place. I feel like,
yeah,
I'm not looking for someone to complete me. I don't even know if I'm looking, but like, if there is somebody who wants to walk alongside me, I can't envisage myself living with anybody or whatever. I kind of really enjoying.
But no, actually your relationship requirements are entirely different at this life stage.
Yeah.
Especially if you know, you've had children.
Yeah.
So actually you're not looking to mate. You're looking,
no.
I mean, my girlfriends in that same position describe it as the quest for sex, dinner and mini breaks.
Yes. But this is exactly, a psychotherapist friend of mine said exactly this. She said, there's a new kind of breed of women now, my age-ish, who are not doing the conventional relationship things. They are doing the best bits. They're doing the dating, the dinners, as you said, the holidays. And I think it makes things so much easier. But still having a sense of, you know, commitment and loyalty.
A relationship.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. But it's funny, I think.
It's more rip their pants off than wash their pants.
Yes. Yes.
Once you've been looking after people from the age of 8, I think you're ready for that bit now.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I'm done with wiping asses, that's for sure. So like, I don't want to be wiping.
You wait, there'll be grandchildren in about 5 minutes.
Well, and you then, see yeah, that I think will be again. Different. I think that will be different, won't it? Because you can enjoy them in a different way. And I am looking forward to that, and it could just be around the corner, I don't know.
Yeah.
But you know, I think I'll make an excellent grandmother.
Absolutely. You are well practiced.
Yes.
And twinkly and naughty.
Yeah. Oh, I'm going to absolutely ruin them. I will ruin my grandchildren.
Ooh, revenge.
Can't help it.
Ulrika, thank you so much for talking about so many things with me today. How's your white wine question time been?
Oh, it's been, honestly, it's been like a mixture of therapy and hanging out with a girlfriend. Like, for me, this has just been really enjoyable. Yeah.
Good.
I mean, you know, it's not been without its challenges, I have to say. So thank you. Because we've got to be challenged, haven't we?
Absolutely. But you know what? It's you know, that's something that you, that rings out loud and proud from everything I've read about you. You continue to challenge and question. You remain curious and you're not afraid of difficult conversations.
No.
So more power to you.
Thank you.
My thanks to Ulrika. Don't forget, you can read her column every Saturday in the Sun newspaper. As always, this show is produced by me, Kate Thornton, with Gabriella Colasurdo and Richard Hatherall for Yahoo UK. Editing is from Libby Knowles Music. Andy Bell, as always, is the man behind the beats. We'll be back next week with more great chat. In the meantime, you know what I'm going to say? Go on. Give us a rate. Give us a review. We'd really appreciate it if you did. I'll see you next week. Before we go, if you've been impacted or affected by some of the themes under discussion today and want to talk to a skilled, trained professional regarding rape or sexual abuse, then visit the Rape Crisis website to find out more on how you can access the help you need. Their address, rapecrisis.org.uk. Thank you.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.